Many of us are familiar and have been familiar and loving Ursula Le Guin, who was Portland's own author extraordinaire. She created worlds in which people who had despair in the one they lived in could live free and easy. She was quite a remarkable woman who died at 88 on January 22nd. She was interviewed, I can't tell you when it was actually that she was interviewed, but during that interview, she spoke about the fact that love was so elusive and that we didn't seem to know what to do with it. Ursula was never one to shy away from difficult subjects. Many of you know, or many of you don't know, that she was quite a poet as well. And in one of her collections, there is this poem, which I'm going to start off with, because our topic for today was intended to be raising the voices of women who live in the margins, women whose voices are often dismissed and denied. And we have managed, with the help of all of our wonderful woofers here, to put together a message this morning that is not going to stray far from that subject. But I'm going to start with this poem by Ursula Le Guin, which does stray a little bit from what we think of as those women who are marginalized. We identify those usually, the women in prison, women who suffer from addictions, domestic abuse, sexual assault, mental disorder, and some who suffer just because of the color of their skin. We're going to hear more about those in a little bit, but let's begin with this poem by Ursula Le Guin titled College. When I was in college, one of the graduate students was my instructor in the course in What a Woman is to Be and the vocabulary. Soon I spoke only in four letters, the language of our love. He taught me how to lie, both down and to, and I was a straight A student. Next, he started teaching me why women have abortions. I wanted to drop that course. "Hey," I said, "look, let me teach you trust. It's really easy. I have so much of it. You don't even have to learn it. I can just give it to you." But he taught me that he didn't need anything I had because he had tenure at a very old, exclusive college. So I learned my lesson, and I paid the tuition, and I was graduated without honors. But we'll not leave it there. This is a poem titled "Read at the Award Dinner, May 1996. Beware when you honor an artist. You are praising danger. You are holding out your hand to the dead and the unborn. You are counting on what cannot be counted. The poet's measure serves anarchic joy. The storyteller tells one story, freedom. Above all, beware of honoring women artists, for the housewife will fill the house with lions, and in with the grandmother come the bears, wild horses, great horned owls, and coyotes. Consider yourself warned. We will be bringing you now some of the bears and the coyotes. So, here we are. We have four speakers this morning. We're going to look at the original theme, which was women in prison. Unfortunately, here at WOOF, and I said and fortunately, not unfortunately, here at WOOF, we have the three Patricias. And the three Patricias, Pat Lycan, Pat Tangerman, and Tricia Knoll, have a particular ministry in that they go down to Coffee Creek, the women's prison, and are part of a book club there with the inmates. Pat is going to talk about that first. Pat Lycan.
The chaplain at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility is Emily Bro, a UU minister. A few years ago, she started the book club, and it's for both inmates and outsiders, or free worlders. Emily, who's known as Chappie to the inmates, says straight out, it's not really about the books. It's about the opportunity to meet and talk with each other. At an informational meeting the first year she offered this, Emily explained that we'd be going into the maximum security and meeting women who were in for 20 years to life. And one of the people at the meeting asked, what do you have to do to be in for 20 years to life? And Emily said, murder. You have to have murdered someone or to have participated in a murder. So that's one reason why it's extraordinary to participate in this group. From the inmates' perspective, the book club is the only group in which such a large number of free worlders, there's about 12 of us, meets with a group of about 12 of them. Ordinarily, outsiders come in one or two at a time, and they're there to preach or to teach something. We come in as peers, as equals. One of the inmates tells me there's now a waiting list to get into the group. The women are very interested in our clothes and our shoes. They all wear sneakers, blue jeans, with a big orange Department of Security shield stamped on the thigh, and dark blue t-shirts or sweatshirts that also have the big orange stamp. But I notice their shoes, too. We sit in a big circle in the chapel, and when someone is talking, I sometimes stare at the floor listening, and I notice their sneakers. The inmates' shoes are clean. They only walk on floors that are regularly mopped. And when they go outside, they're typically on a concrete slab. Even the soles of their shoes are clean. Because all the inmates wear that same dark color, they crave color. And they often comment if one of us wears a bright bracelet or a colorful sweater. And because of that craving for color, they love it when they see dandelions blooming in the yard. They're so pretty, they say. They're always sad when the grounds crew gets rid of them. Chappie says after she started working at Coffee Creek, she never looked at dandelions the same way again. On a recent visit, Chappie asked the inmates how they keep in touch with nature. And one young woman said, it comes down to the minute, the smallest things. She talked about a moment of anticipation when you're standing in front of a door for it to be opened and the guard hits the buzzer and you know the bolt is about to release. That moment between the time you hear the buzzer and the clunk of the bolt and the door swings open and you can smell fresh outside air. That's her connection to nature. One woman is fascinated by the fence surrounding the prison, the immense chain link fence with rolls of razor wire. And once she talked about going out in the yard after an ice storm had coated everything. She stood staring at the links of the fence long enough that the guard came over and asked what she was doing. Looking at the fence, it's beautiful, she said. Get back inside, the guard said. Another time, she talked about how she likes to sit on her bunk and look at the fence. It looks different at different times of day, she says, and at different seasons. And she can look through the fence and see the trees beyond. One day, she said, I was looking at the fence the other day, and we all laughed because we know she likes to look at the fence. And she said, and the sun hit the length of razor wire and lit it all up. She paused for a moment, and then she said, now that was a gift. On another day, one of the women talked about how much she likes the bathroom located off the chapel room where we meet, and all the inmates nodded. By that time, we free worlders knew that most of the women share a small cell with a roommate. They share a bunk bed and a desk shelf that's built in, a sink, and a toilet. There is absolutely no privacy. And the guards passing by can also look in the cell at any time. So when she said how much she liked that bathroom off the chapel, I thought privacy was what she was referring to. But instead she said, sometimes I just go in there and turn off the light and stand in the dark. And Chappie sat back in her chair and said, oh. And then she explained to the rest of us, the lights never completely go off here. They're only dimmed at night because the guards have to come around and do a count. And some of the women learn to sleep with a foot outside the covers because if they can't see you, they're coming in. I never know what I'm going to hear or learn during these book group sessions, but sometimes I come out of Coffee Creek with such new appreciation for dandelions or darkness or fresh air.
This morning we perhaps learn to love some that we have thought were unlovable. Jennifer Frickman is up next, and she's going to share some stuff about alcoholism and addiction. Women alcoholics, you may notice this, you may know this, are treated quite differently than men. We're used to having men get drunk. Not so with women. Their behavior is more highly criticized, and they are held much more accountable. Jennifer, come enlighten us some more.
Thank you, Salima. I'm going to talk a little bit about women and alcoholism, and then I'd like to read a poem. My source is the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, and the title of it is Alcohol, a Women's Health Issue. Basically, one of the things that I've learned recently is that women are at much greater risk for alcoholism than men, and there are a number of reasons for this. Especially as we age, our bodies do not repair themselves easily as they did. And so very often the damage we do drinking alcohol in a problematic way, alcoholic way, stays with us. So there's another interesting thing about women and alcoholism. Women do not secrete enough of the enzymes necessary to metabolize the alcohol in the bloodstream. And so it tends to be stored in fat, and women have more body fat than men do, and therefore it's in the body longer, and the longer it's there, the more damage it can do. And you know, keep in mind, I'm talking about alcoholic drinking, not having a drink once in a while. You know, women also, even if a woman has been drinking less over a shorter period of time, this is true for her, women are at greater risk for alcoholic liver disease, hepatitis, and cirrhosis. Women are more vulnerable than men to loss of mental function, reduced brain size, and the functions of brain cells. Cognitive damage shows up much earlier in women than it does in men. Research suggests that women are more vulnerable to men for alcohol-induced brain damage, osteoporosis, heart disease, and you name it. It's not a great thing. Heavy drinking can also increase the risk of breast and digestive cancers, especially if a woman smokes in addition to her drinking. And women are more susceptible to, osteoporosis. So women are particularly reluctant to be labeled alcoholic. And this means that generally it's still true that women drink alone in a state of isolation. And isolation is not good for anyone, but for an alcoholic, it can be lethal. As Salima said, part of the reason is that women are more reluctant to come forward because the social stigma is much greater for women than it is for men in the case of heavy drinking. And they also tend to shy away from treatment programs for the same reasons, especially now that our healthcare is compromised. So that's just basically what a few facts that I have learned. The CDC is a good source of information. The National Institutes of Health, Council on Women and Alcoholism. I encourage everyone to read more. And now I would like to read a poem that I wrote for my mother. My mother died of alcoholism. She died of alcoholic cirrhosis. And it's ugly. The poem is called Passing. It was more than half my lifetime ago you died alone in a hospital bed, liver hard and yellow as a doormat. I was not able to tell you in those last few moments that I loved you. I did not know if I did. That last visit, your hands hung limp, fingertips cold, ochre. I could press them flat with my thumbs. You tried to speak, could not. My anger and fear could not speak. That day you looked small and dried, reduced to thin lips, bloated belly, useless hands. You left me no clues as to where you were going, no final beautiful act, no vital sign, and no one could go with you. There were purple iris in your garden that summer, vermilion poppies. The linden tree in the backyard hung with yellow waxy flowers, filled with bees. As always, the summer mesa behind our house rose golden and shimmering in the sunlight. As always, pine trees in the foothills released sweet, dusty knots of pollen. Summer was soft that year, like plums wrapped in dark silk, but you could not taste, could not grasp. The night you died, suspended between metal bars of that hard and narrow bed, you took with you no petal, no dust, took no photograph, no daughter. Now I wonder, will you return to your untended garden? Do you walk among knotty iris roots, brush past milky poppy stems? Can you see me peering into the dark, transparent wake of your passing form? Summer flowers bob together, grasses rustle in the breeze. I cling to the idea of you as a green June beetle clings to swaying reeds. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. So We've heard about women whose criminal behavior has marginalized them, and whose disease and or mental disorders has marginalized them. And now, from Kat Schmidt, Claudia Rankine is a poet, American poet. I don't know if her name is familiar to you. She has written a number of books. Her newest, her fifth book, is called Citizen, an American Lyric. Rankine was born in Jamaica, grew up in Kingston and in New York. She's 51 years old, teaches at Pomona College. And from the start, her work has troubled the distinction between what in Citizen she calls the self-self and the historical self, challenging our sense of the lyric's natural territory as the exclusively personal outside the scope of politics. Citizen begins by recounting in the second person a string of racist incidents experienced by Rankine and friends of hers, that kind of insidious, did that really just happen? That affronts, that startle in the moment, and later expand poisonously in the mind. A friend jokingly calls you a nappy-headed hoe when you show up late for a date. Let us then go on and look at the jokes. Rankine says there are those that they're just wonder, and they say, they refer to the boisterous teenagers in Starbucks as niggers. They stand out. They are being around black people, they say, is like watching a foreign film without translation. Rankine takes all this to heart. She takes it on, and she puts it out there. Kat, will you come and share with us some readings from Citizen?
Thanks, Salima. This is the book. I highly recommend reading all of it. The route is often associative. You smell good. You are 12, attending Saints Philip and James School on White Plains Road, and the girl sitting in the seat behind you asks to lean to the right during exams so she can copy what you have written. Sister Evelyn is in the habit of taping the 100s and the failing grades to the coat closet doors. The girl is Catholic with waist-length brown hair. You can't remember her name. Mary? Catherine? You never really speak except for the time she makes a request, and later when she tells you you smell good and have features more like a white person. You assume she thinks she is thanking you for letting her cheat and feels better cheating from an almost white person. Sister Evelyn never figures out your arrangement, perhaps because you never turn around to copy Mary Catherine's answers. Sister Evelyn must think, these two girls think a lot alike. Or she cares less about cheating and more about humiliation. Or she never actually saw you sitting there. The rain this morning pours from the gutters, and everywhere else it is lost in the trees. You need your glasses to single out what you know is there, because doubt is inexorable. You put on your glasses. The trees, their bark, their leaves, even the dead ones are more vibrant wet. Yes. And it's raining. Each moment is like this. Before it can be known, categorized as similar to another thing and dismissed, it has to be experienced. It has to be seen. What did he just say? Did she really just say that? Did I hear what I think I heard? Did that just come out of my mouth, his mouth, your mouth? The moment stinks. Still, you want to stop looking at the trees. You want to walk out and stand among them. And as light as the rain seems, it still rains down on you. You are in the car in the dark, watching the black tarred street being swallowed by speed. He tells you his dean is making him hire a person of color when there are so many great writers out there. You think maybe this is an experiment and you are being tested or retroactively insulted, or you have done something that communicates that this is an okay conversation to be having. Why do you feel comfortable saying this to me? You wish the light would turn red or a police siren would go off so you could slam on the brakes, slam into the car ahead of you, fly forward so quickly both your faces would suddenly be exposed to the wind. As usual, you drive straight through the moment with the expected backing off of what was previously said. It is not only that confrontation is headache-producing, it is also that you have a destination that doesn't include acting like this moment isn't inhabitable, hasn't happened before, and the before isn't part of the now as the night darkens and the time shortens between where we are and where we are going. When you arrive in your driveway and turn off the car, you remain behind the wheel another 10 minutes. You fear the night is being locked in and coded on a cellular level and want time to function as a power wash. Sitting there, staring at the closed garage door, you are reminded that a friend once told you there exists a medical term, John Henryism, for people exposed to stresses stemming from racism. They achieve themselves to death trying to dodge the buildup of erasure. Sherman James, the researcher who came up with the term, claimed the psychological costs were high. You hope by sitting in silence, you are bucking the trend. You and your partner go to see the film, The House We Live In. You ask a friend to pick up your child from school. On your way home, the phone rings. Your neighbor tells you he is standing at his window watching a menacing black guy casing both your homes. The guy is walking back and forth talking to himself and seems disturbed. You tell your neighbor that your friend, whom he has met, is babysitting. He says, no, it's not him. He's met your friend, and this isn't that nice young man. Anyway, he wants you to know he's called the police. Your partner calls your friend and asks him if there's a guy walking back and forth in front of your home. Your friend says that if anyone were outside, he would see him because he is standing outside. You hear the sirens through the speakerphone. Your friend is speaking to your neighbor when you arrive home. The four police cars are gone. Your neighbor has apologized to your friend and is now apologizing to you. Feeling somewhat responsible for the actions of your neighbor, you clumsily tell your friend that the next time he wants to talk on the phone, he should just go in the backyard. He looks at you a long minute before saying, he can speak on the phone wherever he wants. Yes, of course, you say. Yes, of course. The new therapist specializes in trauma counseling. You have only ever spoken on the phone. Her house has a side gate that leads to a back entrance she uses for patients. You walk down a path bordered on both sides with deer grass and rosemary to the gate, which turns out to be locked. At the front door, the bell is a small round disc that you press firmly. When the door finally opens, the woman standing there yells at the top of her lungs, "Get away from my house! What are you doing in my yard?" It's as if a wounded Doberman Pinscher or a German Shepherd has gained the power of speech. And though you back up a few steps, you manage to tell her, "You have an appointment." "You have an appointment?" she spits back. Then she pauses. Everything pauses. "Oh," she says, followed by, "Oh yes, that's right. I am sorry. I am so sorry. So, so sorry."
So what we know is that no matter what the situation, no matter what the cause, no matter what the history, if a woman is to become something more than she has been identified as, she has to start somewhere. Gail Foster is going to share with us in closing Mary Oliver's beautiful poem, Journey.
The journey.
One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save.
Thank you all. Thank you all for being here. Thank you all for being willing to hear what we had to say. And thanks especially for your flexibility. We will bring Julia Yoshimoto back another time. In the meantime, let us ponder some of what we've heard. Let us think about it. And let us close.